Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I think there was a rule that you should never share a stage with children or animals. I think I'll add to that, or people are clearly a lot smarter than you are. So today I've got that challenge. What I'll try and do is give you a bit of a rundown on the current state of play of various aspects of the economy. I'm pretty modest about my forecasting ability because I think that in terms of forecasting the future, many of you would have had dealings with economists and you'll know that there are two types of economists when it comes to forecasting. Those who don't know the future and those who don't know they don't know the future. So I'll push through a few areas. I'll touch on interest rates. I'll touch on equity markets. Don touched on those. I've got more charts than everyone else, but I won't force you to look at them all. I've given you out a chart set, and if there's charts I don't touch on that you think are interesting, we maybe be able to do them in the in question time. So I'll take a through a few things, federal budget, an aspect of the housing market, and also I'll leave you with a solution to one of your biggest problems, and that's how to halve your retirement incomes problem. So we'll start with the easy stuff and move on to the hard stuff. Interest rates, there's probably only two or three things worth saying. The first one, Don touched on this, all around the world, low and stable inflation is breeding low and stable interest rates. The early 90s recession in Australia, in New Zealand, in Canada, in Britain, in Europe, smashed inflation down to low single-digit levels, and central banks have had a fairly easy time keeping it there. Certainly a much easier time than they thought they would. I was in the Reserve Bank when the Reserve Bank introduced its inflation target in early 1993. 2-3% was the plan. Inflation had settled at 2% after the recession. There was hope that they could keep it down, but there wasn't much confidence that it would be an easy task. But it turned out China turned up. Wage fixing went from the centralised model of the 70s and 80s to the decentralised model of the 90s and beyond. And I think pretty well the wage breakouts that were problems in earlier decades really just haven't been able to continue or haven't been able to show up at the peaks of cycles. Pretty well nowhere in the Western world are large groups of workers getting pay rises over and above what's justified by productivity, because everyone knows that if you give out unjustifiably large pay rises, you're basically cutting your business throat. So there's just much more discipline in price and wage setting. So pretty well everywhere, low and stable inflation is breeding low and stable interest rates, and that's one of the reasons why bond yields are low. Another reason is obviously that the whole world is rushing around trying to find some yields that are relatively high. So bond prices are high relative to earnings. House prices are high relative to rents. So most asset prices are at pretty high levels, and that's one of the things that Ray Block is worried about. I certainly won't be critical of Ray today because I've learned this morning that, in fact, his son is my wife's boss. So I'll be very careful about anything I say in terms of Ray's presentation. In terms of forecasting interest rates, I don't think it's a tough job, and I don't think my boss thinks it's a tough job either, because my pay relative to everyone else's pay has been falling over the past decade. But the basic idea is that central banks get worried about inflation. They're all the central banks are targeting inflation. They're all trying to keep inflation low. So they've got a model in their head that basically says medium-term inflation risks are related to the tightness of the labour market. So as unemployment falls and wage pressures build, central banks tend to edge rates up. So in Australia, we've got an unemployment rate right now, you can see, at about 4.5%. It's a three-decade low, so wage pressures are building. The Reserve Bank has responded to that by hiking 8 times in the past 5 years, back to 6.25%. It hiked 3 times last year. It had 3 quarterly inflation reports that gave bad news. It hiked on each occasion. In late January, it got a comforting inflation report, so it did nothing. So it's on hold until the next inflation bad news. New Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens was in Perth the other day, and he told everyone, someone asked him about whether there was a general rule of the Reserve Bank not hiking in an election year. He said, no, that would be crazy, because there's an election year every 3 years and it would be silly for the central bank to tie its hands behind its back, you know, one-third of its lifetime. So if we get some bad inflation news, either at the end of end of April or at the end of July, then yes, the Reserve Bank could raise rates further. But we've seen that it's been one very careful step at a time over the past 5 years, and so you know it's not any more scary than that. We're at 6.25. Each additional rate hike from a decade high needs to clear a higher bar to be justified. So, you know, if people are frightened about interest rates, there's still fixed rate loans out there for 7%. But for now, we're just sitting there with both the Reserve Bank and the Fed on hold until they get some bad news on inflation, either explicitly from the CPI or the unemployment rate coming down further. I think that the trend unemployment rate is your best guide to the pressures on monetary policy. Unemployment's been coming down in both these economies for the past several years, so there's been upward pressure on interest rates. Right now, there's a little bit of upward pressure on the US unemployment rate, perhaps. So that's why some people are thinking that the next move might be down. But my strong view, and it's not that interesting, is that policy is on hold for the foreseeable future, till mid-year at least. Beyond that, any emerging trend in the unemployment rate from 4.5% will tell the story. So if we get some upbeat news and unemployment's punching down towards 4%, then you can bet the Reserve Bank's getting a bit antsy and thinking about taking rates up higher, because as the unemployment rate has been coming down to 4.5% in Australia, wage pressures have been building. I think the single best guide to wage pressures in our economy is expressed in the NAB survey. It's a very, I think, reliable series. Movements in trend tend to give the right answer. So there's a gradual upward trend in wage pressures, and that's why the Reserve Bank still has a tightening bias. Ditto the Fed. I'll jump ahead. So there's my little summary. You've got the handout, but the basic idea is pretty straightforward. Until there's a hard landing in the US or something disturbing in the US, the Fed won't be cutting rates. There's talk of a rate cut, but so far nothing bad has happened to justify a rate cut. So both the Fed and the Reserve Bank have pushed rates back up to more normal levels. They're slightly restrictive, but the central banks almost must be thrilled with recent events, in the sense that unemployment is as low as they want it to be and inflation remains well contained. So and that they've managed to do that without putting interest rates up very high. So the central bankers are very well placed. In the US, talk about a hard landing. So far, there's no hard landing. A hard landing is when you lose a lot of jobs. That was the early 2000s recession. The most recent data show jobs running at 100,000 or 200,000 a month. That's a very happy story. So until that starts sliding, there's no real basis for worry about the economy. Or there's no basis to think the Fed's going to cut rates just around the corner. The main worry in the US is housing. The Fed cut rates to 1% to promote the household sector activity, to promote house prices, to boost home building activity. Once the economy got back on its feet, it puts rates back up. Housing's the most interest rate sensitive sector, so home building's fallen. It's in the percent. So home building, the blue line has come down. Home builder sentiment's come down the green line, and so there's still sort of a decline in home building to come that could hurt the economy. But interestingly, the green line is stabilised, so home builders are less pessimistic than they were 6 months ago. So that's sort of a happy story. I guess the sad story is that blue line's come down a long way, and it looks like that red line is due to come down a bit. So maybe the 20 or 30,000 jobs to be lost per month in the home building sector. And that's against job gains of 100,000 to 200,000. So far, so good. There's been no hard landing. There's still some pressures there. There's still a big group of market participants who think that the housing sector is going to drag the economy down enough to justify rate cuts, but that hasn't happened so far. And it's not obvious it is going to happen, given that sentiment is turning. Alan Greenspan is touring the world, or at least appearing via video conference around the world, saying the worst is over on US housing. Don mentioned that the PE ratios in Australia and the US are still fairly comfortable, and that's because profits have grown rapidly in both economies. you can see the red line getting running doubling while the blue line went down in the second half of the 90s. That was Exhibit A for the bubble in the US stock market. But more recently, the S&P 500 pushing up towards its old highs has been a function of rapid profit growth in the US. And we've got a similar picture in Australia where profits have grown strongly, and they've grown strongly in part because the industrial stocks are doing well, the financial stocks are doing well, but particularly because the mining stocks have done very well, because commodity prices have doubled and trebled and quadrupled. So whether the P/E ratio has been broadly stable because prices for the aggregate market, prices have only risen as strongly as profits. Whether you think that's a good time, whether the low P/E ratio represents a market that's going to do well going forward, just depends on your view on commodity prices to some extent, and your view on whether there's a recession around the corner. So far there are no sort of big signs that everything's about to fall apart. But then again, if it was just around the corner, I don't think many economists would be able to tell you anyway. And certainly, it's a struggle. But all the signs at this point are good, but they always are at the peak of any boom. We've had 15 years of good growth, and hopefully we'll have a lot more years of good growth. But the future is unknowable. So there's the terms of trade. Our commodity prices have surged. China's building stuff and selling it to us at cheaper and cheaper prices. So we're sending over iron ore and coal and things, and they're sending at higher and higher prices. They're sending us back big screen TVs at lower and lower prices. So our terms of trade is just our export prices relative to import prices, and they've basically pushed through the roof. And so that's the biggest rise in our terms of trade in over half a century, and it's also to the highest level in over half a century. So that's been adding something like 1 percentage point to our national income growth each year for the past 3 or 4 years. So that's a happy story. It's been a happy story for Canberra. With the employment to population ratio at all-time highs, with corporate profits to GDP at all-time highs, and with terms of trade at all-time highs, it should be no surprise that Canberra's tax take is also at all-time highs. What is surprising is that the Treasurer feels the need to publish a series that doesn't show that. On any credible measure, Canberra's tax take is higher than it's ever been. So Treasurer Costello is the biggest taxing Treasurer in our history, which is no great shame, because that's true of most Australian Treasurers, because there's been a general uptrend in the tax to GDP ratio. What's happened in recent times is simply that the corporate tax take has gone from 2 or 3% of GDP to about 5, 5.5% of GDP, and that's taken up to a new level. So if you count all the money that goes to Canberra and take away all the money that goes from Canberra to the states, you're left with Canberra's own revenue, and that's about 20% of GDP. That's the red line. And that the average of history is about 18. So there's been heaps of money for spending. There's been heaps of money for tax cuts. There's been heaps of money for big surpluses. And the reason is there's never been more money flowing to Canberra. And so in an election year, you can expect more spending, more tax cuts, and also more projected surpluses, because the Australian economy has been doing so well for so long that it basically has been generating these rivers of revenue. House prices are the favourite of many. So the blue line is Australian house prices. They ran much more quickly than US home prices for much of the boom. They've stabilised for a few years, but Perth has gone through the roof. The main thing that drove the doubling of our home price, the more than doubling of our home price in the past decade, was simply inflation fell sharply in the early 90s recession. Low and stable inflation bred low and stable interest rates. So mortgage rates in the second half of the 90s were half the mortgage rates in the second half of the 80s. Everyone figured out that if interest rates had halved, that they could borrow more. So all across Australia, existing homeowners and potential homeowners said, hey, I can borrow more and buy a better house. And so many people did. There was a massive increase in demand for better housing, and a better house for some people was a bigger house. For lots of other people, it was a house closer to town or closer to the beach. So there was a massive surge in demand for houses in our capitals closer to town, closer to the beach, and that I think was the single biggest driver of the big rise in home prices. Another factor was a halving of the capital gains tax, which basically suddenly meant that capital gains, nominal capital gains, potential capital gains were worth 50% more in after-tax terms. So there was a rush to be a property investor because Australians love property, so that was the obvious first. When capital gains tax was halved, that was the obvious thing to get into was property. When the property boom ran out of puff, the next obvious thing was shares. And so shares of property doubled, then shares have doubled. And anyone who's been an investor who made the switch in 2003 has done very well. I think that's 30 seconds. All right, so I better solve that retirement incomes problem for you. The reason retirement incomes have become a big issue is simply because we're living longer. A century ago, the average life expectancy at birth was 57 years. Now it's about 80. So there's been a quarter of a century added to our lifetimes. It wasn't added to our 20s. We're still only 10 years in the 20s, 10 years in the 30s. So it's been tacked on to the end of our lives. So it's after we were supposed to have... our retirement's been stretched out by a quarter of a century. So if you retire at age 55, you've got to fund a three-decade retirement on average. And if you've gone away and funded a three-week holiday, it puts a pretty big dent in your bank account. Now try funding three decades of holiday. So that's the issue. And the funding problem has been a function of rising longevity. So everyone's living, on average, people are living longer, living healthier at older ages. Some of my colleagues here, apparently they're older than 40. So the trick, obviously, is if you can't fund the lifestyle you like at age 55, then you have to work longer. And so if it's 30 years at age 55 and it's 15 years at age 70, you can halve your retirement incomes problem by working those extra 15 years. I think someone said that's work till you drop. Thank you.